Good evening. I'm Darren Vaughn with the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, the Communications Director, and welcome to the sixth episode of our Drawing Your Path to Success video series. I'm here tonight with Tony Opatz, our pronghorn biologist, and we've got a lot of interesting things to go over regarding pronghorn hunting here in 2023-2024. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind you all of some deadlines that we've got coming up. The deadline for the overall deadline for applications is March 22nd for the big game draw, and also to get your harvest reports for deer, elk, pronghorn, and turkey. If you don't get those harvest reports in, all of your draw applications will be rejected, and obviously nobody wants that to happen, so make sure that you get those in. If you're interested in some incentives for early application, the deadline for that is March 15th. If you can get your applications in by that date, you are eligible for some incentives. So get those in if you're interested. The harvest report deadline for Barbary, Ibex, Oryx, and Javelina, and also for any trapper license holders, is April 7th. Check out our magazine website at magazine.wildlife.state.nm.us for hunt forecasts for all of the big game species. So Tony, what's new for 2023-2024 for pronghorn hunters here in New Mexico?
Yeah, so as you know, and hopefully a lot of other people in the state know, we just had a 4-year rule cycle change, and so we did pass a new rule through the Game Commission. There have been some changes, some big, some small, but the biggest change by far is that we did push hunt dates back this year. So for most units, if the units you know of have three hunts, our new first rifle hunt goes from August 26th through the 28th. Our second rifle season goes from September 30th through October 2nd. And our third rifle hunt goes from October 7th through October 9th. And so, as most of you are probably aware from hunting in previous years, those were in August, and we pushed a lot of those dates back to help alleviate hunters from some of the heat and to align more with biological processes that pronghorn are going through during their year and through their breeding process. So that's been pushed back. That's a really big change. Make sure to check your units to see what seasons are there, because those have slid back. Archery season this year is, or the next 4 years will be August 12th through the 20th. And then some smaller changes that did happen. We did have some tag adjustments in units just to keep on track with how populations are going. We dropped tags in the northwest corner of the state in particular, and a few other units. And then also the muzzleloader, no scope on muzzleloader rule also applies to pronghorn hunting as well. So you'll see that in the regs too. So there are a few muzzleloader hunts for pronghorn, and you cannot use scopes on those, just like all the other big game species. Mm-hmm. So those are the big ones. Mm-hmm.
And just a reminder, all of those are printed in our rules and information booklet. You can find that online or at our area offices or at various vendors throughout the state. So pick up your copy of the rules and information booklet and check that out. So this past week, you and I were among a group that was out trapping some pronghorn out near Wagon Mound, and relocated them to the department's new property out at the L Bar. What was the primary reason for that process? And you know, tell me a little bit about how the department conducts these kind of relocations and what takes place during these projects.
Yeah, so the department's been trapping pronghorn in the state for a very long time. It's been well over 50 years that we've been using this method, and we've kind of tested it and worked out a lot of kinks. And now we're to the point where we can move, you know, usually between 50 and 150 pronghorn at one time through a trap design. It's a funnel with a couple of wing fences, and we all know pronghorn don't like crossing fences, so we have a couple fences set up, and we'll funnel pronghorn in large herds with a helicopter into that funnel and push them down into a large corral that we've built out of big 10, 12 foot fencing and some tarps, and we funnel all those animals into one area and push them through the other side, and we can get hands on every single animal, affix collars on them so we can get GPS locations from these animals we're moving, and make sure that the animals that we're planning on moving are all in good health and can make that journey to the release site. So we do these translocations periodically. Usually it's when a landowner comes to us and says that they have too many pronghorn and they want to remove them from that area, and then we work together to get this trap site built up, and we'll move animals throughout the state. Sometimes we've exchanged them with Mexico or other states around us. Some Native American nations have also come to us and asked us for pronghorn to be moved to their lands as well. And we've worked with a lot of other areas to do it. And this year we felt that the newly acquired Elbar property over by Mount Taylor and the Marquez would be a good site to focus on reestablishing a pronghorn population. There's still some remnants of old populations that are in the area. I think Laguna has a few on there and other landowners in that area, but we really want to give a kickstart to that population and help it produce up to its full potential again. And so we moved 77 animals this last week out there.
Pretty impressive. And how is the pronghorn population, how does it stand in New Mexico right now? Is it increasing, decreasing, steady?
Yeah, so right now we're at about 64,000 animals, and that's from our last summer's surveys. That number is decreasing. if anyone saw the videos from last year, we were talking just over 70,000. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of a nationwide issue right now. Pronghorn have not been doing well kind of throughout their whole western distribution. Mm-hmm. The whole country has been having issues with water and the timing of rains, and suffering from a lot of drought. You'll see some states that have even bigger populations than ours cut tags this year. And it happens, you know, it goes through fluxes and we get some cyclical stuff with weather. But it hasn't been doing the best. We have seen a decrease in particular. So we're working on getting those numbers up, and hopefully we can get some really good moisture coming in this year.
Mm-hmm. And where are some of the areas that you can most commonly find pronghorn here in New Mexico?
Yeah, so it's really common about the eastern third of the state. All the way from north to south, you'll find pronghorn out there. In particular, our northeast quarter from Raton to Clayton, down to kind of in the Tucumcari area, and all the way back over to Las Vegas, New Mexico. That giant square of our state holds probably about 60% of the population of pronghorn. It's a dense herd. They frequently do well, and there's a lot of really good habitat out there for them. And that's your best area to go to see them.
Hmm. And kind of an interesting fact that I noticed, they refer to pronghorn as being antelope, but I guess biologically they aren't technically antelope.
Yeah.
What family do they actually fall under?
Yeah, so pronghorn are actually part of the Antilocapridae family. They have their own family. They're the sole member of that family. All the other members of that group have since died out a long time ago. And so they're on the Antilocapridae is at the same level as your Bovidae or your Cervidae, which would be like bighorn sheep for Bovidae, and your Cervidae would all be your deer family. Mm-hmm. So elk and mule deer and white-tailed deer, mm-hmm, are all in that. So they're basically as different as bighorn sheep are to deer. Pronghorn are as different from any of those. Mm-hmm. And they've been, in the past, have been categorized in both families as a subfamily. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as it stands right now, they're sole and separate. And there's some hard classifications with them because they do have horns, like your Bovidae family, mm-hmm, but they split, which is something that's not common at all. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they shed those sheaths every year, which is something that, you know, your deer family does when they drop their antlers. And mm-hmm, so, yeah, they're kind of a hybrid between those two, but not in either of them right now. Yeah, and it's pretty cool to see. They're very unique species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually read that their closest relative is the giraffe.
Yeah, yeah, and okapi, which is another African animal out there. So yeah, they're very, very different.
Mm-hmm. So when you go and look, like when you do surveys, what are some of the numbers that you're looking for, especially when it comes to buck doe and fawn doe ratios?
Yeah, ideally we like to see buck doe ratios in the 33 bucks to 100 doe range. That's kind of a indicative of a healthy herd. It has room to grow. The males can, you know, fall into multiple harems of does and, you know, kind of do what they need to do. And then for our fawn doe, really we'd like it as high as we can get it, I think at any point. If you keep in mind that pronghorn does are almost always pregnant with twins and they have a very high pregnancy rate, up over 90%. So, you know, in nature, when they're giving birth, they're pretty close to 200 fawns to 100 does, which is a lot. Because pronghorn don't have a higher survival rate, anywhere around 50 to 100 would be ideal. It's a realistic number that we could probably get. But in most areas in the state, especially in southern reaches of pronghorn populations, 50 to 100 is high. That would be really hard to obtain in most regions. So, you know, anywhere we can get kind of in that 30 to 100 range is also pretty ideal for around here.
Mm. And what are some of the factors that typically affect pronghorn populations? And, you know, you mentioned the rains and things like that. Is it too early to see what the long-lasting effects of, say, last year's monsoon season are?
Yeah, so those kind of two questions. The first one, factors that affect those pronghorn populations, drought is huge. It drives a lot of survival in this state, not just with pronghorn, but with most big game and small game. That rainfall really has a big impact, and the timing of that rainfall has a big impact on these individuals. We see issues with roads and fencing, loss of habitat or perceived loss of habitat where they think they can't get to that next pasture because they see, you know, a road or a fence in the way and they don't want to cross it. We also see, you know, new developments of homes popping up in areas that used to be occupied by pronghorn. And so all of those are really big impacts. We also have predator populations that do eat fawns for pronghorn, and that impacts it as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think the you can see effects from last year's monsoon. I think it affected a lot of populations, but for pronghorn, the timing on it just wasn't right last year.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, we like to see those rains, and it's early for monsoons in New Mexico, but we like to see those rains right around March and April.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives enough time for the forbs that pronghorn primarily eat. It makes up about 80% of their diet. It gives those forbs time to grow up and reach a point to where pronghorn can see them and eat them. And that helps build a good nutritional plane for the females that are giving birth to the fawns in June or so. And so last year we had a good monsoon rains, but they came much closer to June and July.
Right.
And by that point, you know, the moms are so energetically deprived trying to produce milk for these fawns.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have much food to get them to produce that milk. And,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, when the fawns hit the ground, the moms are at a real, real low state. And we've been seeing that probably for the last 3 or 4 years in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So back to the surveys, what is it that the department is looking for when you do these surveys, and when do you typically do them?
Yeah, so we start our surveys right around the 1st of July every year, you know, give or take a couple days, and we usually wrap up right around the end of July. We don't want to fly our surveys when people are hunting, especially for the species we're surveying. So we try to slide them in into that 1 month of July. And we usually survey about a third of the state. So it's a large area. We spend a lot of hours in that plane every year. And when we're flying, we're doing a method where we're looking out the window and we're assessing how far animals are from the plane. And it allows us to get an idea of densities of the animals on the landscape. So we
mm-hmm.
can, get an idea and extrapolate that to a larger area, like a whole GMU. And then we also are looking at bucks, does, and fawn numbers out of those groups. And so when we're flying, we fly about 200 feet and we fly down that low. And in the couple of seconds you have to look at a herd and stay along with it, you're looking for total number of animals, the number of animals with a black cheek patch for the males. And some of them are young enough that it's very difficult to see. And then we're also counting the number of fawns in that group and looking at how many fawns survived to that point, you know, right before hunting season. And all of those numbers help us calculate the sex ratios, the buck doe fawn doe ratios, and that also helps us calculate how many animals are in a certain area, the density of those animals. And we put all those together to help come up with all of the numbers that we use to set licenses at.
Mm-hmm.
And assess herd health, I guess, too.
And as far as population management, how valuable are those harvest reports?
They're extremely, extremely important. And I would encourage everyone who hunts, even if you don't have to turn in a harvest report to do it, every little bit of that information helps us assess, you know, we can keep track of the animal side of things from our surveys, but I can't keep track of the hunter side of things unless they tell us where they're getting to. And so that helps us determine whether hunting success is good or bad in a unit. You know, we might be seeing one thing from the air, but if people aren't able to hunt them, maybe those animals are moving off of that range in the fall period versus the summer when we survey. Or there could be a number of different disconnects that we wouldn't see unless, you know, hunters provide us with that data. And it goes a really long way. It helps us, you know, come up with all these numbers. And then when we're looking at new rules for the next 4 years, we take into account hunt success in those units. And if hunt success has been, you know, trending down, there's obviously something we need to look at there.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any tips for people who are planning to apply for a pronghorn hunt in this year's draw? And, you know, how can people increase their odds of actually drawing? Because I know that a lot of people go for the most popular hunts and then wonder why they haven't drawn for several years.
Yeah, it happens every year. I get a lot of phone calls about people putting in for units with five tags and not drawing those hunts. I'd say first and foremost, look at that draw odds report. The department puts it out every year for a reason. It's to help hunters, you know, kind of figure out what's going on. And then in the rule and information booklet, when you look inside of it, you can see the number of tags that are going to each hunt inside of a unit. And obviously the more tags that we're giving out, the better odds you have of drawing. And so keep that in mind when you're looking at some of these units. You know, if it's a 10 tag unit, it's pretty hard to draw a tag every year or even every 10 years on some of those. Take a look, see how many people are applying for those tags and weigh it against how many tags we're issuing in that unit. And it'll go a long ways. You really can't be afraid to explore new parts of the state. There's pronghorn throughout most of New Mexico. And it always helps to explore a new location and figure out a new herd and you know, learn more about pronghorn hunting in general. And that'll help you a lot. And then the other alternative is use a weapon type that you aren't used to. A lot of people put in for rifle hunts. It's, you know, the classic way to Western hunt. And archery hunting can be a serious challenge when you're hunting pronghorn. But there are a lot of archery tags and units. And so, you know, you can weigh that your odds of success against actually drawing a tag and getting that opportunity to go out and chase the animal that you want to hunt. It's a lot of different elements, but yeah, keeping track of all of those kind of help people get a good unit.
So there's obviously two kinds of hunts here. There's the public land and the private land, and there's also the ranch wide program within the private land hunts. So how does that ranch wide program work, and also how do the rules differ for private land pronghorn versus other big game species?
Yeah, so our ranch-wide program is a program designed to kind of almost land swap some public and private hunts for individuals. Landowners will sign up to be enrolled in the program, and when they're enrolled, they'll be allowed to hunt their public lease land. So if they lease BLM, State or Forest Service land, They can take a number of tags that we negotiate as a department with them to hunt those public acres. And in exchange, the public can turn around and hunt all of their private deeded acreage. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to continuing to hunt that public land as always. And so those individuals that enroll in that program, we publish their ranches on our website every year. We put maps up there. It usually comes in around the start of July, right around July 1st. We'll post those maps to give people time to see if they drew a unit that has one of those ranches in there. It's a small program. There's right around 10 individuals involved in that right now. But it does open up several hundred thousand acres of hunting land to the public. And so it's a really good program to look at and familiarize yourself with and at least see if there's a unit-wide ranch available in the unit that you drew to hunt. And then, yeah, you can drive around out there. You don't have to contact the landowner beforehand. Just make sure you know those ranch boundaries and, you know, as always, respect the property you're on. Mm-hmm. And leave it better than you found it. And then I believe your other question was about how it differs from other big game species. Mm-hmm. All in all, it's very similar to what we have for deer hunting in the state. You know, private lands over the counter with those licenses and unlimited in all the units. And so, you know, if you want to go hunting on private property, I suggest talking with the landowner first and getting one, you know, set aside for you to go hunt. But the reality is you can walk in and purchase private land tag over the counter, and then you'll select a GMU that you want to hunt in and one of the hunt codes that corresponds with, you know, your hunt dates for that unit. Mm-hmm. And then you're allowed to hunt with written permission any private ranch inside of that unit. Mm-hmm.
So that's where it differs between that and those ranch-wide, is that mm-hmm. the ranch-wide ones, you don't need the written permission. Mm-hmm. The over-the-counter private land, you do need written permission.
Yeah, yeah. And you'll need written permission from everyone. You know, you can hunt the ranch you would talk to. You can hunt their neighbors if you aren't finding mm-hmm. animals there. You know, you just need to make sure that you get written permission from those landowners and carry it with you when you're hunting. Uh-huh. So in case you get stopped by our conservation officers, you can go up there and, you know, show them all of those details that say you can hunt there.
Uh-huh. So for people wanting to, or I guess people who have successfully drawn a hunt or have bought one of those over-the-counter tags, what are some tips that you have for people wanting to go out and scout beforehand?
Yeah, I always recommend scouting beforehand. It helps. It beats showing up day one and just picking the largest chunk of land out there just like everyone else did. Uh-huh. And pulling up, and then there's 50 of you in the parking lot opening morning. It can, if you do a little bit of scouting, you'll narrow some better regions down than that, I guarantee it. I usually recommend about a month before your hunt, or 2 weeks before, something like that, go out. Pronghorn are super easy to see, especially if you have good optics. It's a really, really key part of pronghorn hunting is having a good set of binos, a good scope on a rifle. Being able to see those animals from a long distance really helps. And so, you know, you can drive public roads and just, you know, take out your favorite GPS app, whether it's, you know, Onyx or something, you know, carry maps, drive around and start, you know, documenting areas you're seeing these pronghorn and whether they're on public or private land. And I'll even record them on private land as I'm on that public road, because they do cross fences and they will move in between where they're at now and your hunt. And so, yeah, get as much land covered as you can. Find glassing points that you can climb up to that give you a better vantage point. Start taking a look at that. See if they're crossing fences at certain locations. Those are really good areas to target, or if they're using the landscape in a very specific way. They aren't as agile in terms of moving up and down vertically across the landscape. And so, you know, large arroyos or rock formations will cause them to move around, unlike, you know, mm-hmm. some mule deer or elks would not. And I think that's a good place to start when you first go out, is just start driving around and looking. It also gives you a really good idea of what bucks look like in your area, so you can know what to expect when you show up on opening morning. You know, mm-hmm. if you see a giant that that, you know, you probably saw 40 or 50 pronghorn before this and they all look the same. And then you see that one, you know, it's different from everything else. It really, really helps out to do, put that time in beforehand.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add? Any last words of wisdom for our New Mexico pronghorn hunters?
Keep applying, keep trying. You'll get a tag eventually, and they do come up, and really enjoy your hunt when you get that tag. You know, there's a lot of other people that put in, and if you're the individual that draws, you know, it's a really special thing to get a pronghorn tag in New Mexico, and I just hope that, you know, I want to thank all the hunters for putting in. You know, they keep conservation of wildlife species at the heart of what it is, and we couldn't do the work we do without them. And I think that's super important to keep in mind, and just to enjoy hunting, keep getting outdoors, get kids involved, get, you know, your neighbor involved, just try to continue hunting. Don't get discouraged, and get after them.
Well, thank you so much, Tony, for all your time and all of your advice. I'm sure that a lot of the pronghorn hunters out there are definitely appreciated. So again, our upcoming deadlines, the incentive deadline is March 15th. The big game draw deadline and also the harvest report for deer, elk, pronghorn, and turkey is March 22nd. Barbary, Ibex, Oryx, Javelina, and Trapper License Holder Harvest Report deadline is April 7th. So the other episodes in this series are available on our YouTube account under the playlist Drawing Your Path to Success, this episode included, and also our final episode, which will be coming up next week with Nicole Tatman, our Big Game Program Manager. She'll be talking about Ibex, Oryx, and Barbary sheep. So, for Tony Opatz and our cameraman Ryan Darr, I'm Darren Vaughn, and we'll see you next week, and best of luck in the draw.